stories were all but forgotten. We think that the Houston police didn't even translate the newspapers that he was publishing, and yet the group, the leaders of the group that were at the center of his criticism and his writing, they remained prominent members.
AC Thompson, we have 10 seconds. The information that you've gathered, is this going to cause the reopening of these murders?
You know, I have no idea. I certainly think there are new leads here. Should anyone want to follow them, there is new information.
We're going to do part two of this conversation online at democracynow.org. I want to thank A.C. Thompson and Rick Rowley for this remarkable documentary that aired on Frontline, Terror in Little Saigon. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a development director. Check our website at democracynow.org. And we have internships. Check there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland welcomes Corey Morningstar, who has written about the nonprofit industrial complex and the inconsistencies within the environmental movement.
Your community radio station is having a book and record sale. Saturday, November 14th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the annual KBOO Book and Record Sale will be at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. We'll have fabulous books and records, CDs, DVDs, classics and surprises, and treasures to discover. Again, that's the KBOO Book and Record Sale, Saturday, November 14th from 10 to 4 at Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. All proceeds go to support your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky on Thursday, November 12th at the Q Center in Portland. The book traces the occupation of Zuccotti Park and some of its counterparts across the United States and around the world, from inception to eviction. Even if the movement fails to achieve radical reform, Gould-Wartofsky maintains its offshoots may well accelerate the pace of change in the United States in the years to come. Again, that's The Occupiers, a reading and book signing with Michael A. Gould-Wartofsky, Thursday, November 12th, at the Q Center, 4115 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in this Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. We will be discussing the case of Reverend Edward Pinckney, who has been imprisoned for up to 10 years for election fraud.
It's so important. This is basically a news blackout of all the stuff that goes on up there in Michigan in general and in particular in Benton Harbor. It's awful.
That's the case of Reverend Edward Pinckney this Wednesday at 9 a.m.
Industrial streets, class lines, money talks, turning language to paper pieces, rich man's war, free man society, raging violent insecurity, nuclear man, nuclear woman, unclear how to act, rich man's war, Pershing's cruising Europe, America, Russia, governmental nuclear views. Industrial allies cutting the world as though they cannot see blood flowing. Rich man's war. Central America bleeding, wounds same as Palestine and Harlem. Three Mile Island in El Salvador, Pine Ridge in Belfast. Rich man's war.
The poor, starving for food, starving for land, starving for peace, starving for real. Rich man's war, attacking human, attacking being, attacking earth, attacking tomorrow. Rich man's war, thinking of always war, thinking of always war. With machines for ancestors, new unborn generations, chemical umbilical cords are only wiring. In your electrical progress, human lives burnt offerings to the god greed. With lies for ancestors, there is no truth in some futures. Rulers of minds feeding next generation souls to the control machine. Sacrifice ritual for the profit technology. With isolation for ancestors, there's only the present, bought by the credit material uses. Forging chains binding you to destruction. The complements of your deities, the industrial priest.
This is a I guess we had a problem with the microphone, and my name's Paul Rowe, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO, and I play that song by John Trudell and Graffiti Band to recognize this day, Veterans Day, created by the nation state about 100 years ago or so after the slaughter of the First World War, and I guess the nation state after sacrificing so many people during that mayhem, which is essentially from many readings, to suppress the revolutionary spirit, which was perhaps at its height. We may never see anything like that again in terms of a overall challenge to the empire machine. Anyway, I don't want to minimize the experiences or pain of veterans who have had to go through warfare, which I have not, and I hope not to, unless it is the final war against this empire machine, warfare machine. And so that's my statement here on Veterans Day. Fight the empire, fight the warfare state. Let's not have any more veterans. Unless, of course, we all become veterans of the war to end the empire. So, before we go to my guest, Corey Morningstar, who we have on the line from Eastern Canada, we'll talk to her in a minute. I just wanted to mention on the subject of fossil fuels, which we'll be talking about the illusory victory of the decision on the KXL pipeline not, of course, an allusion to the people and tribes of that region who, through grassroots organizing, helped stop that project and are obviously celebrating their victory. But we're talking about the larger picture of the movement of fossil fuels, specifically the movement of tar sands fuels and the movement of Bakken oil field oil through massive pipeline networks. And we'll be talking about that with Corey in just a minute. But Portland itself is going through an interesting process, some call historic, to make a stand against the fossil fuel insanity. And they passed a ban on increased oil train utilization of tracks through the city of Portland last week. And they're going to be meeting tomorrow, the city council, to consider a resolution that would put in place the strongest policies against fossil fuel shipments in the country at a municipal or any level. The resolution would put in place binding policy that would prohibit all projects to create new or expanded large-scale infrastructure to store or transport fossil fuels in Portland. Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fritz are sponsoring this resolution, and we need to make sure the rest of the council joins them. So people are encouraged to write to city council, tell them you support the resolution banning major new fossil fuel transport and large-scale storage infrastructure. Apparently, Nick Fish and Dan Saltzman from, I have no way of knowing this myself, but I'm given to understand that they are perhaps on the fence, and people are encouraged to contact them in particular, and Steve Novick as well. Nick Fish is at 503-823-3589. Steve Novick, 503-823-4682. Dan Saltzman, 503-823-4151. You can call me at the front desk after the show. I'll be there even though we're closed at the office here, and I'll give you all that information. And there's just go to a ban on fossil fuels city council. If you have access to the internet, you can find out all this information. So that's tomorrow, Thursday, November 12th at 2 p.m. at Portland City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. Let's bring up Corey. Hello, Corey.
Hi.
Good morning. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Okay. It's a few hours later there. I've had a little more time to wake up.
Yeah.
So, you've been covering, you have a blog called The Wrong Kind of Green.
I have a blog with a few other people, Gregory Vickery, Forrest Palmer, and a few others, and it's called Wrong Kind of Green, and then I publish my personal writings on The Art of Annihilation.
What's that again?
It's called The Art of Annihilation.
Uh-huh. And we hope to have Forrest Palmer on. He's out of Houston, so obviously he lives in the area at the bottom end of this pipeline, that particular pipeline network, known as Keystone XL, which of course has been constructed and operating for many years. So he has an interesting perspective on that. And he wrote a piece called Keystone XL, The Specter of Truth, in which he made some very interesting parallels between the Civil War and the different reasons given for the Civil War and the ending of slavery, and making an analogy to what we could call the war on nature, or the war between the rich industrialists and fossil fuel industrialists, and the rest of us, I guess, or especially the people most directly in their path. But of course, with climate change, we're all in the path. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. That is an amazing read, and I recommend to everyone listening that they go to Counterpunch or Wrong Kind of Green to find that article. And basically, the premise is that the Civil War lie is comparable to the Keystone XL narrative, in that people are taught that the Civil War was fought for preservation of the Union, in the same way that people will say that the Keystone XL quote-unquote war was fought to save the environment, when it is only being used as a red herring to get people to focus on this one single pipeline, while business as usual is destroying us.
And again, so that was published, I guess, just today in Counterpunch?
Yesterday.
Yesterday, okay. And that's a website that I cite often, and I've interviewed people who who write on that, as you have as well, Corey. And you yourself wrote a piece called Truth Between the Lines, the Breaking Keystone XL Pipeline Rejected Announcement Circulated by 350.org, where you pretty much go down the line and sort of deconstruct this particular, I guess, email that 350 sent out. And so I thought that was very... Very important to talk about. But you also have a piece just today called Keystone XL Construction Deconstructed. And I just want to read one paragraph, because I think there may still be, on the part of listeners listening to this program today, some confusion about what it is we're exactly talking about, just because there has been, KBOO has reported on the fact that there's all these, that basically the functional route from the tar sands down to the Gulf of Mexico that the Keystone was meant to service has been functioning for several years. And, other people have started to report that, partly because of the kind of reporting you and others have been doing. But I think there still is some confusion about what it is we're talking about. So let me just read this paragraph.
Sure.
The entire Keystone pipeline system, with the exception of the much-hyped Phase 4, which constitutes 327 miles of pipeline. That's the one that would cross the Ogallala Aquifer through the Dakotas and Nebraska, has been built and in operation. The first phase having gone into operation back in 2010. Phase 1, 2,147 miles, went online in June 2010. Phase 2, 291 miles, went online in February 2011. Phase 3A, 435 miles, went online in January 2014. 47 miles of additional pipeline will come online in 2016, which will then complete the project. Basically they patched together a variety of existing pipelines to basically make this functional. So that's basically the argument you're making. But behind that, there's a much bigger argument, which you've been talking about over the last couple of years in a long series of articles on, again, Wrong Kind of Green, analyzing what you call, and others have called, the nonprofit industrial complex, and a much larger picture of what is really going on in basically the global economy and the attempt, I guess I would call it the attempt to save capitalism. Would you agree that that's a accurate characterization?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I mean, the nonprofit industrial complex is basically an extension of the state to protect capital.
And of course, let's get clear that there's many different kinds of nonprofit organizations, KBOO being one of them. And there's, I don't think you would include necessarily all of nonprofits in this characterization of the nonprofit industrial complex. Is that true?
Not necessarily, no.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe just elaborate a little bit.
Well, the ones that are, what happens is there's such a dependency. I mean, these NGOs we're talking trillions and trillions of dollars per year are pumped into the nonprofit industrial complex, from foundations and the oligarchs down into the NGOs. And it's actually the best investment that they have. I mean, it's the best thing money can buy, because on these... groups begin to they grow accordingly to the foundation money that's coming in, and they become absolutely dependent on this money, and they're beholden to those that the hand that feeds them, not to civil society and not to the public.
And of course, that's sort of analogous to the situation I would say the vast majority of us find ourselves in, being whenever we have a job that we may not like or, you know, may not be in line with our values, which I think pretty much is, I would say, the large majority of us. Well, I'd say, speaking for myself, obviously a lot of people have aligned their values with the kind of work that they do. So that's not true. But many of us who, you know, believe that we are in opposition to whatever capitalism or war or destruction of the environment, most of us are not able to have the kind of job that would, you know, that actually is in line with those values. And then, you know, there are these groups that are ostensibly working against those things, whether it's the large green groups or whether it's various peace and social justice groups. But to the extent we're trying to analyze behind that and establish some sort of criterion of effectiveness, I guess, because it's really hard, since clearly things are not going well.
A large part of the nonprofit industrial complex is to form strategies that have people acquiesce to what the funders have already designed in the back rooms, to plans they have ready to roll out. And so, that's a main part of what they do, is basically social engineering and acclimatize society to what the elites already have in store for us, which is to protect capitalism and expand capital and create new markets. So that's what it's all about. I mean, it really requires a lot of critical thinking, and that's something that's not being nurtured in our schools nor in society at this point. I mean, this whole Keystone XL campaign has been framed from the beginning as though it's a proposal on paper that's never gone forward, and it's incredible how many people think today that none of this has ever been built, when the truth is 89.8% of the whole thing has been built and in operation today, with 89.9% of it being approved, with phase 3B coming online next year. And of course, there's no discussion about 3B. The truth is that they don't need this, the one that's been temporarily suspended, phase 4, they don't need it. I mean, the global economy has slowed down. There's a huge glut right now, and there's not enough storage for all this oil. I mean, we have crude imports from Canada breaking all-time record highs, and there's a glut. So the victory is actually theirs, not ours. I mean, they have a whole country of people celebrating a victory. They didn't need that pipeline right now, at least. And they have another part of the equation that's been left out, is this huge rail empire that's been built as a direct result of this campaign, where all eyes were on this one pipeline. Well, Warren Buffett, Obama's financial advisor, built this massive 21st century rail dynasty, as well as Bill Gates. And I mean, there's just a media blackout on that. There's no mention of it anywhere. And in 2013, in July, 47 people were killed, a whole downtown in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, Canada, was wiped out from a crude via, you know, we call them bomb trains. And so, I mean, this is another huge, huge component of this, which, you know, gets no mention, which, you know, it's not really a surprise when you consider that Warren Buffett funneled $26 million from 2003 to 2011 into the Tides Foundation, which distributes and doles out all the money to the tar sands campaigns. So, I mean, this is really a lot of spectacle and a lot of strategic planning.
So it's going to be difficult to get to the entire complexity of the argument that you're making here, and I do encourage people to go and actually read this. I think this is some of the most important stuff you can read if you care about climate change and ending the fossil fuel empire. That's my opinion. You can make up your own mind. But you're very critical of 350.org on a national level. And again, you know, we had you on the on my show about a year ago, I think, and there was some pushback from local organizers, including 350.org. And I do want to make a distinction between local organizers and national. And I know that I've worked with people with Portland 350.org and other groups, and there's a lot of really good organizers working on that, doing really good work. And I think that's always important to recognize. And I think your argument is that what happens is that a lot of the accomplishments and organizing by grassroots activists sort of gets taken credit for and sort of recuperated or appropriated by some of these national groups. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And I want to make it really clear that my work is for the people on the front lines. I mean, I am in awe of the people that actually put their bodies on the line. You know, all those people on the front lines, the land defenders, the warriors, that's who I'm writing for. And so just because I'm saying, look, you know, we have to look at this so we can succeed in the future. If we're going to have real victories, we have to look at reality and look what happened here. That does not mean that I don't absolutely respect, you know, these people like sacrificing and putting their bodies on the line. And I think we owe them a lot, and I think people should stop sending their money to these big green groups and start supporting those people on the front lines.
And I want to quote you before we open up to the phone lines again in this one article, your most recent in this now 12-part series, which is called McKibben's Divestment Tour. Well, no, it's it's all about what you're talking about here, the nonprofit industrial complex behind the sort of the overall climate change strategy and fossil fuel strategy, which is coming down from on high, as it were. McKibben's Divestment Tour, brought to you by Wall Street. Part 12, Building an Acquiescence for the Commodification of the Commons Under the Banner of a New Economy. This really blew my mind. It really started to help me understand a lot better what it is you're really getting at. Basically, what you're talking about is what's really behind at the highest levels of strategic thinking amongst the elites. And is specifically related to, as we're going into a month before the Paris climate agreements, really dealing with this, you know, the realization that this climate change issue is something that can't totally be ignored, but at the same time, they can't seem to actually accept the idea that what's causing climate change is a growth-oriented industrial economy. And so they're trying to have, I guess, eat their cake and have it too, as they say. And so before I let you respond to that, I just want to flag, before I forget it, this person you cited to me, Clive Spash, who's an ecological economist. He did a really excellent paper on the upcoming Paris climate talks, responding to a document, a really key document released. And I think if you're anybody who really wants to understand this stuff, I think this is what you need to focus on personally. So this document released in September 2014 called Better Growth, Better Climate, the New Climate Economy Report, the Synthesis Report. And he deconstructs that. Because again, in that document, and again, the strategic thinking, and from what you're saying at the level of Bill McKibben and 350.org and the people that they're associating with, that's what they're really talking about, is how to continue to have growth and supposedly resolve the climate crisis, which I guess you would say is impossible.
Yeah, it is impossible, and that's what it's all about. And actually, this quote-unquote victory is tied into COP21, because you can see from what's happening and all the global marches and everything being planned, the quote-unquote win, the victory coming up at COP21, is already being implemented behind closed doors, and it's being designed and planned for years, if not decades. I mean, before this is the thing. We have to stop swallowing whole what the nonprofit industrial complex spoon feeds us and start doing our own research, because otherwise we're never going to win any of these battles. And I just wanted to mention as well how ridiculous it is in the past. Think about this. As soon as this announcement came out, instantly you saw, like, NRDC, Sierra Club promoting these slick videos where you transform Barack Obama into the world's greatest, you know, war criminal, terrorist, into some sort of a climate leader icon. Well, those types of videos take time. They're not created in 1 hour or even in a day. These are high finance productions. They knew in advance that decision and knew when it would be rolled out. I mean, 350.org has been in The Guardian, it's been reported at least once, secret visits in the White House. I mean, these are all the same people, the Democrats, Avaz, 350, they're all one and the same. And while the U.S. is promoting, energy independence in the Bakken, North Dakota, you've got this huge social and ecological devastation unfolding before our eyes. You've got 12-year-old girls being, in the sex trade, being trafficked. You've got human trafficking involving children. You've got the further genocide of indigenous people, and no one flinches. No one cares. We've got a war on women there and a full-blown genocide. And so why are we looking at, you really have to think at the same time, promoting Obama as this icon. We've got the Obama administration leading destabilizations and occupations all over this planet, stealing oil resources. It's pathetic. We're not seeing the bigger picture. And then, of course, back to what we started with, what you were saying. Now they want to hold our hand and welcome us to the quote-unquote new economy, the next system where we now privatize and commodify all Earth's resources, the final resources that are left, with the corporations becoming the new stewards of nature. And where is this? You won't find one NGO anywhere campaigning against this or even talking about it. And it's all happening right now behind closed doors.
So this is I think, one of the more difficult things to come to grips with. And I kind of wanted to get back into some of the specifics of your reaction to the announcement by 350.org. But I want to do that in a minute, because I think this is important, at least to get some of the basic concepts out there for people to do who want to do it, to do further research. Because I remember, it's been about 25 years when there's a book called Ecosystem Services came out. And people, it was kind of this new idea. It was like, this is a way that we can actually, a way to protect the environment by putting a real value on on what the ecosystem provides for us in terms of water, in terms of topsoil, in terms of all the different elements, the extremely complex elements that ecosystems provide, which of course can never be quantified. So the whole enterprise is kind of doomed from the beginning, in my point of view. Plus the idea of actually putting a monetary value is against the entire spirit of what I consider ecology or environmentalism. But anyway, so that came out, and I didn't really follow up on it. But what basically you're saying, and what Clive Spash, the ecological economist, is saying, is that that has been refined and sort of adopted into policy at these high levels that you're talking about, at the high levels of this United Nations Conference of the Parties response to climate change, to biodiversity destruction, et cetera. And it's being adopted at a corporate level. So talk a little bit, what is payment for ecosystem services, and what does that have to do with the so-called new economy?
Well, it's basically basically assigning value to nature. So every aspect of nature that provides the service can be measured and quantified in a monetary sense. It's basically we've reached a point right now where capitalism has nowhere left to go. I mean, the global economy is stagnant. It's in a rut. I mean, you've got the World Bank. You know, this is like a huge, huge problem. There's just nowhere left to go. And then, so of course, you see, if capitalism doesn't grow, it fails, it will fall. And that's actually a key opportunity for, you know, people that want to see a better world to grab that and utilize that opportunity. But instead, what we have is how can we be, you know, continue to grow? How can we keep this system, the suicidal system, going? And to assign value to the whole global environmental, you know, to all the resources on the entire planet, this opens up a massive new market. It opens up all kinds of new markets we haven't even thought yet. It's a gold mine. I mean, the capitalists, the corporations are frothing at the mouth. And like I said, documents explain how corporations will be the new stewards of nature. And it's terrifying as well because, of course, all value is from a human-centric point of view. What we find of value, what appeals to us in nature, will have more value. I mean, I can't tell you exactly how this will actually play out in ways of paying for it and everything else, but I can tell you it's going to be a massive, huge money grab. It's going to create huge markets.
Well, carbon trading is sort of the tip of the iceberg. That's sort of one of the initial things. But of course, it's not the only thing. Obviously, the privatization of water is a massive thing that's going on. And again, like the Nestle fight against Nestle here in the Northwest, and many other communities around the country, is part of that. But you know, we don't recognize, perhaps we don't know that, you know, the Sachs, the CEO of Nestle, is on these major global panels dealing with water policy, where water privatization is like the agenda that's being pushed. So obviously that's a big part of it. But let's talk about...
Yeah, I mean, this is taking that and expanding it. This is the privatization of soil, you know, of fish, of you name it. I should have sent you this before the show, but I mean, you've got... BBC had a little interactive game that they put out not too long ago. And it just says, you know, you play this game and it says, what's worth more? What's her name? Beyonce. I don't even know her last name. The musician, mm-hmm. the artist, or it'll say an eagle, whatever. And the answer is Beyonce, right? Like, she's worth more to the economy. And, you know, that's what all the huge, you've seen, I'm sure you've probably heard of the huge global goals campaign that they just put out. And that's all part of it. It's all linked in together. I mean, they had ads. It's the biggest ad campaign I think there's ever been for the UN. They put ads in hundreds, if not thousands, of theaters across the world. I don't remember the number right now. And anyway, in the theater, when you have your cell phone on, I read an article by the man who designed this campaign. Somehow this ad interacts with your cell phone. I mean, it's complete building acquiescence to the unthinkable, you know, to the worst thing that could possibly happen to both humanity and our, you know, all living things on this earth, all life on this earth. And it's building acquiescence and it's a social engineering project to make us think that this is the only way. This is a really great thing. This is how we're going to, you know, finally protect nature and save it. And it's just a huge commodification, privatization scheme.
And again, my name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And my guest is Corey Morningstar, activist and writer from Eastern Canada, who's on the phone with us today talking about... very large discussion, the diversionary tactics involved in the exclusive focus on the KXL, Keystone XL pipeline, how it is not really a victory, except again for the people directly in the path of that one segment of the pipeline. And that's not to be dismissed by any means. And this larger picture of the attempt to save the growth-oriented, suicidal capitalist system through the complete commodification of nature. It sounds kind of like science fiction. But again, if you read, I mean, I really, you know, people, I think we need just a few more people in every area really focusing in on this and getting together and talk about it, I think would do a lot of good. So anybody out there who wants to focus in on this, go to Wrong Kind of Green blog and look up this guy, Clive Spash, who wrote this report, Better Growth, Helping the Paris Cop Out, Fallacies and Omissions of the New Climate Economy Report, which I think really gets at the real underpinnings of what's behind these the facade of dealing with the climate crisis. And so anybody wants to call in, I know we've gone already 40 minutes, but if you have a pertinent question, I urge you to keep it directly relevant to the conversation, because kind of our time with Corey is at a premium here. The number to call is 503-231-8187. But as I said, I wanted to get to, I know I've kind of jumped around here. I wanted to get to just read the first part of this announcement by 350.org, Bill McKibben, that they sent out on this, on the Obama announcement. And you respond to it. We just made history together. 4 years to the day after we surrounded the White House, which I was there and I got arrested, actually. President Obama has rejected the presidential permit for the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. This is huge. A head of state has never rejected a major fossil fuel project because of its climate impacts before. I just want you to respond to that last part there.
Oh, what I wrote?
Yeah.
In response to that, I say, framing, this introduction implies symbolic state-sanctioned protests are effective in the war against genocide. I mean, these protests at the White House and that, they're all pre-approved by the state before they happen. And sorry, no disrespect intended. I know you just said you were there and got arrested. I want to make clear that it's only because we have people that are want to help and are completely well-intentioned in doing their best who are used and manipulated by these big greens. But anyway, it's funny in that statement there that you just read, 4 years to the day after we surrounded the White House. That's what I was referring to earlier as well. Why 4 years to the day? That was the day they chose, and that was the day they were prepared for. I mean, all these, it just came pouring out, right? The glossy videos, you know, promoting Obama as a hero. All these press releases, they came pouring out all across media. It was already done. They knew beforehand. This is the thing. They work together. I mean, these groups are directly tied to the Democrats. You've got the Climate March. You've got Purpose Inc., which is the PR arm of Avaaz. And their entire staff works with the Democrats or has worked with the Democrats in some way or form. I mean, they're completely tied into one another. And I just wanted to, while we're talking about all the people that go to these, like the White House, or they always have these protests where you go and stand, you know, in Ottawa at the Parliament building. They're always on the weekend. I'm not sure if the one was that you went to, but most always, they're always on the weekend when no one's even there. And what T.R. McKenzie says, who's really, I would call him a land defender, not an activist, but an actual land defender. We don't need 400,000 people marching in New York City. We need 400,000 people protecting land. Like, don't fly and drive and you know, come to New York City. We need people protecting land.
So we have a couple callers. Our first caller is TK. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Hey, thank you for this show. I really appreciate your hard work at KBOO and just the great program matter. You're just not going to hear this anywhere else. I just wanted to make comment on your guest's point about the Keystone XL and how, well, you know, gratefully it's been canceled, and it's really of little benefit. It benefits, well, Obama. It makes him look good, in my opinion. And she mentioned Warren Buffett basically owns the rail lines, and as a major, very significant Democratic donor, well, this bodes well for him, too, because the owners of Keystone XL can't move forward. So it's a win-win for them, and Obama looks good. Warren Buffett continues to make huge profits on his bond trains, and Keystone, well, it's stopped, but only temporarily until the next plutocratic representative gets into the White House.
That about sums it up.
Well, you haven't opened up any other. You have anything else? Any further questions?
Oh no! I just want to make that point and just put it out there, reinforce that point, because it's really important that it's just a sleight of hand and just delay for the real objectives for these folks. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling and making that point. So let's just go straight to our next caller, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul. Hi, Corey. It's Michael Donnelly, and.
Hey, Michael. Hi there.
Thanks for having the show. And, Corey, thanks a lot for all you're doing. It keeps me from having to write it over and over and over again. Sometimes I feel like we're just definitely butting our heads up against the wall because, and of course, Paul knows this from long experience with the ancient forest movement stuff, because whatever we do, these paid foundation, this nonprofit industrial complex you talk about, will come in and water down whatever we do and take over and silence the more pertinent things here. I noticed in all of this, 350 never mentions the fact that the real Keystone's already built. I just noticed today that TransCanada just signed an agreement to build a huge natural gas pipeline to ship gas to Mexico, same company. All this is going on. It's continually going on, but the big elephant in the boiler room, so to speak, is consumption. And nobody's talking about how we have to lower consumption or it's over.
Thanks for bringing that up, Michael.
What? I couldn't quite hear you. But
I said thank you so much for bringing that up.
Yeah, and I wanted to, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Do you think there's any way we can just break through this environmental movement that's just there to promote Democrats and actually have them promote the things that are actual solutions, the only possible solutions? Anyway, let's hear what you have to say about it. Thanks.
Go ahead.
Do you want me to go ahead?
Yeah.
Michael Donnelly is a fantastic writer, activist, and people should check out his work. And he's done such a fantastic job of bringing that point back over and over again. I mean, like Jeff Gibbs says, the only way to use less oil is to use less oil. The nonprofit industrial complex to expand capital wants, you know, us to believe in the illusion of this third industrial revolution and all these other things that are just based on pumping more oil, burning more fossil fuels. But what we really have to look at is the Western lifestyle. I mean, it's the 1%, and by that I mean anyone that can afford to get on the plane, that create 50%. Of the world's global greenhouse gas emissions. So unless we're going to talk about walking away from this lifestyle, which, you know, in fact, I don't think that very many people are deeply happy with. I mean, addicted, yes. Happy, I don't really think so. There's no way to deal with climate change until we deal with our first world consumption, and that's that.
Consumption and production combined, that's a...
Yeah, like the production, it's produced because it's consumed. So going to the root of the problem and looking at that consumption and why the production happens because it's consumed, I mean, you can just forget about any kind of slowdown in climate change. You can forget about any mitigation. And that is something that the nonprofit industrial complex is not funded to do, because that requires degrowth. That requires true conservation. And true conservation and degrowth does not grow the economy and keep capitalism intact. So you will never hear, you will never see that campaign on a large scale by any big NGO.
Yeah, I just want to, we're just sort of touching on a lot of different things, and I recognize that fact. I hope people also listening recognize that we're really taking on a bunch of different levels at once, and perhaps not addressing them all in the most concise way, but we're doing the best we can, and we're also basically citing a lot of sources that people can go to. So it's really up to everybody on our own also to do this research and to talk to people. So again, this guy, Clive Spash, ecological economist or economical ecologist, I guess ecological economist is more appropriate, has this report which really gets at the kind of at the root of what's really going on with these climate talks. And he has this paragraph. Let me make it clear that this report is that he's criticizing, which is, I think, one of the more fundamental ones called Better Growth, Better Climate, is a lobbying document supporting what has come to be known as green growth, a wonderful oxymoron that is a new utopian vision of a growth economy to replace the old ones of sustainable development, welfare economy, and plain old growth economy. This is an economy that can accumulate capital while decreasing the amount of materials and energy used, an economy that can achieve social equity and the eradication of poverty without any redistribution policy, an economy where people are made happy by conspicuous consumption, competing to buy the latest gadgets and owning more green stuff, not to forget achieving harmony with nature through technology. The commission makes clear the analysis, quote, rests on a considerable body of experience and research, as well as policy and business reports. Work has drawn extensively from this body of applied economic learning. In this paper that he writes, I look at the new climate economy synthesis report as a key document aimed at influencing policy in the lead up to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, Paris COP meeting in December 2015, in just a month. The synthesis is more important than the extensive online background chapters. Anyway, it goes on and on. I think this is really key, but we have a call, so let's go to that caller. Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. So two things that I wanted to just mention. One, I feel like I hadn't really heard about this whole idea of the nonprofit industrial complex until I read Arundhati Roy's Capitalism, A Ghost Story. And she actually lays it out pretty well and pretty articulately in describing how philanthropists, which are basically capitalists, endow these foundations and organizations with their vast amounts of wealth. If we think about the Gates Foundation or the Carnegie Foundation or the Mellon Foundation, these folks took all of their all of the wealth that they had extracted from labor and from the earth, and then put it into these nonprofit organizations. And then the way she explains it is that they fund the projects that fit within their ideology. And so by the very act of funding or not funding a particular proposal, when people submit their proposals for grants, they can determine what is the range of acceptable responses to social, economic, and ecological problems that we face. And so in the very process of picking and choosing which projects or how those projects get funded or what the outcomes of those projects are, they determine the legitimate range of human responses to the crises that we're all trying to address. And that helped me to understand how this so-called nonprofit industrial complex functions. So hopefully that, for folks who were confused up to this point in the show, that might help them to understand how that functions at an ideological level. And then the other thing is I wanted to interject the thesis of the film Cowspiracy, which I just watched recently, and how they argue that this mass agricultural system, monoculture, factory farming, how that is actually a much larger driver than combustible fuel of climate change. And yet, again, going back to the idea of the nonprofit industrial complex, there's absolute silence from 350.org, this year club, all of these different organizations, Tide foundations. So can you speak to that and agricultural development and monoculture and factory farming and what and the patterns of consumption there? You know, here we are in foodie Portland, and all of a sudden now, what, we've got to stop eating meat, maybe? We've got to start looking at eating much more locally, even than we are right now. So if you could maybe speak to the agricultural contribution to climate change and how that fits into this whole picture.
Okay, thank you for calling, Chris.
Should I go ahead?
Sure.
Okay, well, that article, I think it's called Capitalism, a Ghost Story, perhaps, the one that he was speaking to first. It's a mm-hmm. great article, and I recommend to everyone to I forget who published that, India Times, maybe. It's, yeah, fantastic. Can't recommend it enough, and thank you for bringing that up to your caller. And then he's absolutely right about the Cowspiracy documentary as well. That website, if you go to that website and you look at the facts that they have listed, that will just blow you away. So I mean, the World Watch Institute basically came out years ago, and I believe the UN, and said, I believe around 50% of all greenhouse gas emissions are from industrialized livestock. So it's another absolute key thing to address. But of course, like your caller said, no one will address it. It's just like Fukushima, it's just like Buffett's bomb trains, it's just like, you know, a lot of other things, it's just completely blacked out. And very critical, it's not the only piece of the puzzle, of course, but it is a big piece. But if you even suggest to transition to a plant-based diet, it's really difficult, as I'm sure your caller knows. I mean, people really go crazy over the idea of that, and you know, it's not like we're out, not very many people at least are out hunting their own food or anything at this point in Western society. People simply go to the grocery store and buy it. So people, you know, and the meat that they buy anyway is completely disgusting and, you know, probably carcinogenic. It's full of hormones. It's gross, right? It's not like it's healthy in any way. And you know, the amount of it eaten is certainly unnecessary.
We got another caller, and we only have like 3 minutes left, and I wanted to make a quick announcement. So let's, if you have a really quick question, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, Paul. Hey, y'all. Thank you very much for the show. You know, I don't know that you have time to address this question, but, you know, if, say, by and large, I am agreeing with most of what has been said here today, and, you know, capitalism and consumerism, I would love to hear more about how to move forward, what people are thinking are ways to move forward and push through this. You know, we talk about a conversion to a solar wind economy, but I understand the thing about capitalism and consumerism. So maybe next time you would have time to address ways in which we can move forward.
Okay, well,
from that model.
Thank you for that, and I will. I will, and I will, and as sort of that leads to the thing I was originally going to talk about today before I really wanted to talk about this KXL thing and interview Corey again, because it's been too long since we've talked on the air here. But there's a thing that I turned Corey on to recently, which I found over at the Anaris Info Shop on North Lombard, which I want to put a little plug for, and they need some help. They're looking for a renter. I only have a minute left here. So there's this group called the Invisible Committee out of France, and they wrote, they've written a couple things, The Coming Insurrection, and they've also written a thing called To Our Friends, So I would really recommend people reading those things, and we can talk about that. And of course, we don't have time to talk specifically in response to what Mike said, but I'm going to just key those, and also look up the Inaris Info Shop. They're looking for a new renter in their space. They have an office studio space available at 7101 North Lombard. Call 760-525-3652. And you can also pick up a lot of really good zines and a copy of this To Our Friends document. So that might be a good starting point for our next conversation. And unfortunately, Corey, we're out of time, and so much more to talk about. But it's been really good hearing your perspective, and maybe we'll talk again sooner this time.
That'd be great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, we really appreciate it. Again, that's Corey Morningstar, blogger with Wrong Kind of Green, who's written a long series of exposés of what is called the nonprofit industrial complex and the reality behind the smokescreen of the new economy, the green economy, these large-scale attempts to redress climate change, et cetera. But we got to go. So thank you so much for listening. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowan.
Talk about destruction. Folks, don't you can count me in, out, in, out, be. All right.
It's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here what we have, here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on Political Perspectives, host Martin Dodge speaks with Joe Peary, a friend of Reverend Edward Pinckney, a community activist from Benton Harbor, Michigan. Pinckney is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for allegedly changing the dates next to some signatures on a recall petition for the mayor of Benton Harbor. At 9:30, Kristen Yount interviews Michael Gould Wartofsky about his new book, The Occupiers, The Making of the 99% Movement. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, we've got Flashpoints. Today, historic elections in Burma. Also, low-wage fast food workers walk out in support of a $15 an hour minimum wage. And also an update on the recent presidential elections.